Hi, everybody. Today is Monday, April 21st, 2025, and our friend Larry Johnson is back with us. Welcome back, Larry.
I'm happy to be here.
By the way, beautiful shirt.
Yes, it's a gift from Australia, from down under. Down under, mate.
Larry, let's start with Pope Francis. And he passed away. And how do you find Pope Francis and his sort of attitude when it comes to the conflict in Ukraine, in the Middle East? What's your take on him?
He was irrelevant in reality, you know. I guess he comes out of Argentina. I lived in Argentina. But, asked to record what is it that Pope Francis did to stop the war, to call out the West for its aggression against the Christians in Russia, to call out and condemn in the strongest terms possible Ukraine for its attack on the Eastern Orthodox Christians. Too busy to be bothered. You know, they made a few statements, but it was inconsequential. So, irrelevant. You know, it's like, the death of Francis doesn't change a thing with respect to the war in Ukraine. Doesn't change a thing with respect to the persecution of Eastern Orthodox Christians. We just had an incident over the weekend in Moldova where the authorities were preventing one of the senior church officials from going to Jerusalem to attend the ceremony in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So, a genuine spiritual giant, someone who claims to be the representative of Christ, should have been speaking out about this. But, I think over the last 3-4 months, he's been so sick that he's incapable of performing his duties. So now we'll see what comes next. Are they going to continue with the tradition that only a white European can be the Pope? Or are we going to see somebody from the Global South? And if you get someone from the Global South, are they going to be more active in speaking out and condemning this kind of thing?
Yeah. And the second round of negotiations between Iran and Israel. Again, yeah. Both parties are evaluating it as positive.
Yeah.
How did you find it?
Well, I don't think they both evaluated it as positive. It was sort of unbelievably positive. Foreign Minister Araghchi, he came out. He was very upbeat and says, "Hey, we're getting our technical experts together on Wednesday in Oman. They're going to start working out and hammering out the details about what kind of caps on uranium enrichment there will be." And the IAEA will be the inspectors. They'll do the inspection, and we'll meet with the United States next Saturday. Well, good grief. This, based upon the backflip that Steve Witkoff did from a week ago Saturday, when the end of the meeting and said, it went well, and we were talking about capping enrichment. Oh, good. And then he comes back and says, No, they can't enrich anything. We're going to put it, that won't be allowed. Yeah, because he caught some heat from the Zionist crowd. But something happened between the time, I guess it was a week ago, last Tuesday, maybe Wednesday, when he put that, posted that thing on his message on Truth Social and commenting that, no enrichment would be allowed, and basically that intimating that Donald Trump's previous positions, that where Trump had said that the They can't be allowed to have any nuclear program. And they're going to have to get rid of their missiles, and they're going to have to cut off all contact with Hamas, Hezbollah, and the Houthis. Well, you know, once he said that, I realized this, you know, if that was the position of the United States going into this next the round of talks that took place in Rome on Saturday, it would have been the end of the talks, because those were unacceptable demands for Iran. And, you know, somehow Witkoff's position changed again, or Trump's position changed. You know, I can make the argument that there's a, that it would be in Donald Trump's interest to secure, to be able to come out and say, hey, what a great deal maker I am. I got the deal, I got Iran. Iran's not going to build a nuke. We got them to commit not to build a nuke. Well, you know, people would point out, but that was sort of the agreement under JCPOA that you walked away from in the first place. Oh, no, no, this is better. This is permanent. We got the Russians are involved and the Chinese are in supporting. And so we've built peace in our time. It makes sense for him to do that. Now, one of the stumbling blocks, and this was from Witkoff, where he said that Iran doesn't need 20% enrichment. Well, actually, they do, because it's my understanding is that 20% enrichment takes place in the medical field, creating radiological isotopes, and that it's used in some cancer treatments and other things. So, but I think you'll see the negotiations come out with a cap at 20%, and it'll be entirely peaceful, and it'll be verifiable, and the various facilities will be opened up to the IAEA. And boy, at that point, you'll see Benjamin Netanyahu's head explode, because this is really a blow that this takes away the boogeyman that Iran is no longer building a nuke, just minutes from getting a nuke. That's where we got to go nuke them, has been the Israeli argument.
Yeah, we've learned that Israeli Minister of Strategic Affairs, Ron Dermer, he was in Rome after the negotiations. He talked with Witkoff. And the day before, together with the head of Mossad, director of Mossad, they talk with Witkoff. What do they want, Larry? What are they getting the updates from the negotiations? Do they want to influence the negotiations?
Yes, all of the above. they're doing their job as intelligence officers. They're also trying to influence Witkoff if they can. But I think they realize Witkoff's not making these decisions. He is carrying out Donald Trump's marching orders. And despite what Trump has said, if we have to determine reality based upon what Donald Trump says while sitting in front of a camera, man, we're going to be in the twilight zone. He is all over the place. He says contradictory things. The Iranians are fine people. They're great people. There's going to be hell to pay, back and forth. But apparently, when he's sitting with Witkoff and, the cameras aren't around and they're talking as human beings, Trump apparently has he's lucid and sane. And I think when Witkoff may have explained to him, said, look, there's a deal to be had here, but this is the deal. They'll agree to caps on uranium enrichment and to outside inspection, and which means no bomb. What more do you want? I mean, seriously, what more do you want? And that is, take the victory. I think Trump's going to try to take the victory. But we'll see.
Reuters reported that Israel is still weighing a potential strike on Iran's nuclear facilities. What if Israel attacks Iran during the talks between the two parties, Iran and the United States. Do you see the possibility of that?
Well, some interesting developments over the weekend. What is help me with the pronunciation here? Let me find it. Because Iran produced a new over the horizon radar. It's spelled SEPEHR. 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 Oh, there you go, man. You got that R going. Okay. So the Sepehr, what does that mean? Is that actually have a meaning in Persian?
Yeah. Sepehr means the something that is so wide and vast.
Oh, okay. Hey, look at me. I'm doing the interview. You're giving the answers, okay? Judo. I flipped the script. Yeah. So this is an over-the-horizon radar, which has a 2,000-kilometer range, which means, hey, they can see anything that's launched out of Israel. They'll have advanced warning. And so this thing reportedly it can detect takeoffs of individual aircraft or ballistic missile launches. And this means if Israel tries to do anything like that, Iran's going to be aware. And Iran will be prepared and have time to respond. Now, I think it's worth pointing out that Iran's not alone in having to worry about that, because they've also got Russia's intelligence assets, which are monitoring Israel to make sure that Israel doesn't launch a ballistic missile with a nuke on it. Then on top of that, you have anti-missile defense systems. And I think ballistic missile defense systems with the S-400. So if Israel tried to do something like this, I think it'd be the equivalent of Israel committing suicide. Because it would leave Iran a variety of options. I mean, under international law, if Israel tried to do that, and especially if they tried to use a nuke, they would be they'd be a target of many countries. You know, Russia would be getting involved. China would be getting involved. Countries like Pakistan would get involved, and I think maybe this would finally even compel Turkey to get off its ass. But if Iran's able to defeat an Israeli attempt at an attack, then that is, you know, further underscores that that Israel is weak, and Iran is, you know, much stronger than many had given them credit for. So I encourage people that are listening, if they haven't paid attention to Alistair Crook's Substack, Conflicts Forum. His wife, who's a scholar in her own right, terrific lady. She speaks Hebrew, and she comes through the Hebrew press in Israel. So they've got the English version and they've got the Hebrew version. Well, boy, there's stuff in the Hebrew version that you don't see in the English side of the house that gives real insight into the domestic upheaval that's taking place inside of Israel. There's the tensions have been growing internally between, if you will, he differentiates between what he calls the Ashkenazi, those sort of the European Jews, and then you get the Mizrahi, who are sort of the native-born Israelis that come out of the Middle East. They're clashing, and it's a deep, deep split where you've got retired generals talking about prospects of a civil war in Israel with the Jew fighting Jew, and they were not kidding, they're very serious about it. Reports that there's growing discontent and protest within the military itself, and with many reservists refusing to show up for duty. So that's why I said, with what we see from the outside with just the English version of Netanyahu, yeah, boy, we're going to launch an attack. The things aren't as he's not in as strong a position internally. Now, that doesn't guarantee that he wouldn't do something crazy. I think doing anything to launch a nuke at a facility in Iran would leave Iran in a position fully justified, and they would be under enormous pressure to strike back and destroy Israel. You know, it's much easier to launch missiles that can wreak great havoc on Israel than it is for Israel to wreak havoc on Iran, just by virtue of its size. Iran is huge. Israel's small, tiny. So it's not like there are hundreds of targets that Iran would have to go after. So is this, you know, we're still in some, I guess the next big, can we breathe a sigh of relief moment will be what happens Saturday in Oman, when Iran and the United States come back together.
Larry, do you believe that the intelligence provided by Israelis to the United States in terms of their attack on Iran, do they really believe in what Netanyahu and his intelligence are talking about, or they're going to have their own assessment on what has happened in that attack, Israeli attack on Iran? Because recently we had an interview on RT, Russian news agency, that
Russia Today.
Yeah, Russia Today. And they talked with the foreign minister of Iran, Araghchi, in which he said that we can defend ourselves even against the United States, and the United States knows how capable we are. The Israeli regime also knows what our defense capabilities are and what our response to any attack is. Somehow he's just pointing out that they were not able to destroy our defense capabilities.
Right.
They were not that much vocal, Larry, when Biden was in office. I don't know why, but even in those days, you could find it in the Iranian media that the attack on Iran was not capable of doing a substantial damage to Iran.
Yeah.
And here's the first time the foreign minister of Iran talking about it. Can you hear?
Yeah, I can. Are you playing it or?
No.
Oh, the way you said it.
I have just read it for you, that he said that the defense capabilities of Iran are intact and we can respond to Israel.
Oh, yeah. No, look. You could see it visually, you know, some of the imagery that came out on October 27th, the video clips, where missiles, the Israeli missiles were being intercepted, and then, you know, what had happened 27 days prior to that, when Iran had launched its attacks on Israel, and that was, it was specifically targeted. It was more of a demonstration attack, but it was this time they were showing, we can penetrate your defenses and you can't stop us, and our missiles can't hit the targets, which they did. Now, the spin patrol that came out after, you know, October 27th was, oh yeah, they've been wiped out. Iran is now naked. Okay. So what are you guys waiting for? I mean, you know, they're now defenseless. They'll go finish them off. Blah, 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 you know, just a bunch of hot air out of Israel and out of people in the United States. You know, Jack Keane is one of the biggest offenders on this front. So what we saw on October 27th, is Iran had a robust air defense system. They had already an over-the-horizon radar that worked effectively, that there were reports that, U.S. pilots who were involved as well said, oh, wait a second, we're getting lit up here. And so they never crossed the border into Iran. It looks like There may, you know, some, there were some drones that were launched out of Azerbaijan. They came out of, from the north, but you know, they did very minimal damage. There was no significant damage to Iran's facilities. And, you know, since then, I guarantee you, Iran has been working to upgrade and improve air defense, as well as to harden potential sites that would become potential targets. So the Israel would be facing a more difficult challenge. And this time it sounds like Trump's not going to go along with, no, you're not going to do an attack on my watch. You know, I have heard from people that have been with Trump in, you know, sort of private conversations, that that Trump genuinely is someone, he's not one to go out and start a war. He really would prefer, you know, that's not his makeup, his attitude. His, you can't take a lot. He says a lot of crazy stuff out loud that sounds like he's an ultimate warmonger. But apparently, if, you know, if get him in a quiet place over a cup of coffee or something, he's going to opt for a peaceful solution, not a violent solution. So I think the kind of the statement that you read, read by Rakshi, is reflects growing confidence, if you will, on the part of Iran.
Larry Netanyahu, in he feels so confident. He says that, I don't know if you read his latest argument on how Israel was capable of, in terms of decapitation, Hania and Nasrallah, Sinwar, Dave, and all together, and Netanyahu somehow bragging about what he has done so far and how successful Israel was in terms of decapitation. And but when you look at the way that Israel was fighting and just was operating, do you see, apart from Netanyahu being in power in Israel, do you see any strategic win for Israel?
Well, yeah, let's step back and say, okay, they've killed all these top-level people. So that's made Israel more at peace, more prosperous. All the opposition's disappeared, right? You know, it is... It's one of those silly myths that, oh, all you got to do is cut off the head of the snake and then the snake dies. Well, the, you know, the, when you're dealing with entities like Hamas and Hezbollah, they are political entities. They are, they're not an animal with a soul, one little head that you cut off and then the animal dies. They're organic because they're comprised of thousands, tens of thousands of people. You know, we're talking 1 million Palestinians, 2 million Palestinians in Gaza alone. So this notion that, yeah, if you killed them all, yeah, that might solve the problem, but boy, if that's your solution, you're a monster. And ultimately, I think the way out of this, and this is reflected in the Hebrew press in Israel, that the some, you know, retired generals said, look, the Palestinians should have a state. We need to negotiate, give them a state, and we got to stop this war because we can't sustain this. That's the reality. And so Israel, you know, it's one of those, it makes them feel good. Oh man, we killed Nasrallah. Well, Nasrallah has been replaced. And the question you always have to ask is, you know, if we get rid of Nasrallah, who's going to come in? Is he going to be more amenable, less talented, more violent? You know, what do we get? That's why, you know, we've seen the same. we see the same sort of nonsense out of the West with respect to, you know, dealing with Russia. Because they, oh yeah, we get rid of Vladimir Putin. Putin is a representative of something much bigger than just him. This is not a cult personality. And yeah, let's get rid of Putin and put in Medvedev. Oh, that'll be better. If Medvedev had been president over the last 3 years, we would have had a nuclear war. He would have hit the West and hit it hard. And I would understand why he did it. You know, Putin has shown tremendous restraint. And yet, I don't want to shift it to Russia, but the parallels, you see the parallel kind of thinking that you get from Netanyahu. Yeah, we're going to kill all these people, to kill the top level, and then it'll be better. You know, the same kind of nonsense is espoused in the West. And it's ineffective, counterproductive. It's self-destructive, in fact, to pursue that sort of strategy.
Do you think that if Donald Trump could achieve something with Iran, that would influence Netanyahu's position, and maybe the opposition parties in Israel would be stronger and better organized and to manage somehow and getting more power in Israel?
It actually could set the stage for getting rid of Netanyahu. Now, again, this is the divisions within Israel are so deep that if Netanyahu goes, the real question is who would have the political standing to create a government that would be, you know, supported by a majority of the people. One of the fears is that the extremists like Ben-Gavir and Smotrich, Ben-Gavir has put together, it's like the old Nazi brown shirts. He's got a sort of own security organization going, like a private militia. And if they take over, they're in a position where they could clash with the regular police, the Israeli police. So you're looking at a recipe for chaos. But this reconciliation with Iran will force Israel to ask some real tough questions about its own policies. And it really could indirectly set in motion events that would force Netanyahu out. And then you were looking at actually probably a civil war in Israel. It'd be unbelievable.
And Lori, it doesn't seem that if you remember before Donald Trump came into power, we were talking about which conflict would be easier to put an end to. You mentioned the conflict in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Do you still feel the same way?
Oh yeah, that's the easiest one to settle, because all we got to do is pull the plug. You know, stop. You know, cut off all funds, cut off all intelligence support, pour our military and intelligence personnel out, and then Trump. I think Trump's actually in the process of doing that. Because he effectively told the Europeans this last week, hey, you want to go to war in Ukraine? Be my guest, buddy. Have at it. Well, sorry, but the Europeans don't have the capability to do it. You know, they. I had the impression with respect to the Baltic states, because they're some of the biggest. Yeah, man, we got to fight. Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia. The borough, Brooklyn, in New York City. So New York City has five boroughs. Brooklyn's one of them. The population of Brooklyn is larger than the country of Estonia. It's larger than the country of Latvia. These are jokes. They are malicious, malevolent, obnoxious little jokes pretending to be nations. They're not nations. You know, good God, they're not even combined. Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania don't even have the population of New York City. Okay? So, and yet to treat them as if they're serious, I'm pretty sure that the police force in Brooklyn is larger than the military forces, so-called military forces in each of them. So they're militarily, they're not capable of doing anything. I mean, Russia, if Russia wanted to crush them, Russia could. And candidly, some of the actions, the hostility that's been coming out of these three Baltic states and attacks on Russian-speaking people and some Russians who actually, there are citizens in each of those countries that hold Russian passports and the attacks on Russian citizens, I could see at some point Russia saying, okay, wait a second, this is going to stop. You know, they're not Ukraine, that's for sure. But they are threatening. So if Donald Trump pulls the plug, this thing's going to come to an end and come to an end quick. And I actually think we're already seeing the indications that that's on the horizon with just the increased desperation of Zelensky. I think he knows his days are numbered.
How about Rubio talking about, which was confirmed by Donald Trump, if they don't reach an agreement, we're going to leave.
Yeah. They'll be singing that John Denver song, you know, all my bags are packed, I'm ready to go. Leave it on a jet plane.
Who are they trying to intimidate, in your opinion? Is that Ukraine, Russia, Europe?
Oh, you mean Rubio with his statement?
Rubio and Donald Trump himself repeated the same sort of rhetoric.
Yeah, well, if you say to the Russians, you do this or else we're leaving, the Russians will say, don't let the door hit you in the ass. Goodbye. Nice trip. know? Whereas for Ukraine, it's, oh, wait a second. You mean Uncle Sugar is going to cut off our candy supply? Oh my God, our money, our, well, you know, it's a big deal. But I think it's probably the right play. So, you know, here, and the neocons, they'll blame Trump. But who cares? You know, you lost Ukraine to Russia. Okay, you know, so what? We've reestablished normal relations with the Russian government. We've reduced the risk of nuclear war with Russia. I'll take that. I think the way Trump can argue that is a victory, as a win for America, if he wants to continue with his make America great again, America first. And then if he adds to that, hey, I stopped Iran from building a nuclear weapon. Stopped it. There's no more nukes. So you can turn to Israel and say, okay, you don't have to worry about that now. So just shut up, you know, stop pretending that that's a threat. It's no longer a threat. I got it fixed. You know, because right now, you know, Trump is really with his, you know, tariff war with China in particular, the failure to get a deal with Iran up to this point. I mean, the Houthis reportedly shot down two more Predator drones in the last 4 days. So the number is like at least 20 and maybe 21. So now we're talking some serious money. I mean, that's if you go with the $30 million figure, so that's $600 million worth of drones that have been shot down. But others say it costs more like $40 million. Well, that's $800 million. So we're almost at $1 billion with just the drones. And notice that the pace at which the Houthis are shooting them down has dramatically increased. Because sort of during the first 15 months of Operation Prosperity Guardian from December of 2023 all through 2024, and then into January, February, the Houthis were shooting down like one a month. Since then, they've now shot down in 4 weeks, 5 weeks, they've shot down five, maybe six. U.S. we can't sustain that pace of loss. They're not churning out predators, you know, right and left or every day. This is, they're expensive to build and they're time consuming to build. So, you know, when you stack all of that up, Trump is, you know, if he can take Ukraine off the table where he doesn't have to worry about that, leave it to the Europeans and say, hey, you want this, guys? Have at it. Knock yourselves out. Well, France and England, they are shadows of themselves, what they used to be, complete shadows. Still filled with bombast and lots of talks and lots of threats, but they don't have a military industrial base to produce what would be needed, and they don't have the manpower to put into a uniform. You know, they're like children who are dressing up and pretending to be something.
I don't know if you read yesterday, they were talking, there were some rumors that the president Mahdi al-Mashat, he said that the USS Truman is out of service. And if we assume that they do this, do you think that would change the attitude of Donald Trump? We know that he's not happy with this sort of spending. I don't know why he has decided to go to war with Yemen again. Doesn't make sense to me. From you look at the way that he was talking about it and right now he's behaving, it doesn't match for me. Well, and if they do that, is that going to change Trump's attitude?
Well, it's probably that Trump was told, man, these guys are a bunch of pushovers. They just, the Biden folks just didn't try hard enough. They just, you know, they were only throwing pinpricks, gestures. We're going to go get them now. We're going to really go crush them. And then I saw this firsthand, or, you know, during my 23 years working with the U.S. military special operations. So I was working with the most elite forces in the U.S. military, both Army, Navy, and Air Force. And even in those very, very elite units, you would find sometimes a lot of ignorance, you know, particularly after the attacks of 9/11, they just didn't understand the difference between Sunni and Shia. I can objectively show you that the 95% of the violence that get labeled as terrorist attacks and that cause casualties are carried out by the radical Sunnis, not by the Shia. So, that kind of ignorance is there. So I think they went in underestimating the Houthi capability and overestimating the ability of U.S. intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance capabilities to find, locate, and destroy missiles. You know, we talked about this, I think, on Friday, just the problem with the mobile missile system is it's not like the Lord Sauron of Lord of the Rings, you know, that big eye that sits on top of the tower, always looking and seeing. Oh, there it is. You know, we don't, you may have in cities like London and New York surveillance systems that can always see what's going on the streets and, you know, real time. But even if you got that system that you can see real time, you don't have a human capability, and it can be created with artificial intelligence, maybe, to say, oh, here's a problem, you got to go pay attention to it immediately. So that entire process of once you locate and identify a mobile missile launcher, then the decisions that have to pass that information along to a person or group of persons who make the decision to fire, launch, attack, it has comes back down, and then they get into the people that actually, that's a passage of time. And so that's one of the big challenges the United States has run up against, and frustration that they really can't destroy the missiles. You know, it sounds good in a Hollywood movie, but when you get into reality, very, very difficult. So, yeah, it's possible that Trump could get frustrated. We've not had any confirmation on the West, from the West, not even, you know, leaks out to sailors, talking to family members that, oh yeah, man, we took a big hit. I think it'd be tough for them to cover that up if that happened, but it is possible that the carrier withdrew from the Red Sea because the destroyers that are accompanying it are now out of air defense missiles and they have to go reload, and the carrier can't stick around by itself because it would be naked and it would be vulnerable. So that may be what's going on.
Yeah. Donald Trump yesterday posted that hopefully Russia and Ukraine will make a deal this week. Both will then start to do big business with the United States. He's talking about business, Larry.
That's his thing, you know.
Larry,
that's what he's most comfortable doing, that and building, you know, hiring contractors to go build stuff.
That resonates, by the way, with Russia. But we know that the root causes of this problem is much deeper than business. And we know, you've mentioned the situation in Moldova, in Lithuania, Latvia, the ethnic Russians. It's not just about Ukraine.
Yeah,
we know that the main, many people are talking about the NATO expansion, all of that, but one of the very crucial points for Russia to go in Ukraine was the case with the ethnic Russians and the way that the Ukrainian government was treating them, the killing of, I don't know. How do you think that Donald Trump is thinking of that, of having a security architecture, Larry? There has to be something that would consider the right of these people, ethnic Russians who are living in this is the creation of the collapse of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, I don't look. I don't think
some sort of comprehensive deal in that term.
It would be nice if Donald Trump was thinking in those terms, right? You're a man of a generous heart, trying to give him that benefit of the doubt. But I don't think he comprehends yet that Russia's not going to agree to a ceasefire. It agreed to an Easter ceasefire, but you know that's they've done something like that before around a religious holiday, and and recall it was initially rejected by Ukraine. No, but then somebody got a hold of Zelensky and told him he's a fool, that he needed to, you know, go along with it. Russia's demands are unchanged. They're not changing. They're going to become stronger and more vast, because right now all they're asking for is withdraw all Ukrainian military forces and cease all military operations in Russian territory. Russian territory includes Zaporizhia, Kherson, Donetsk, Luhansk. That's number one. Number two, Ukraine's got to cut back on its military. You know, you can have a national police, a border security force, that's fine, but you're not going to build up this kind of military force that you were, where you become a NATO proxy. And have elections, because we're not going to sit here and live side by side with a group of Nazis, with people who embrace and celebrate a Nazi ideology. We're just not going to do it. That's our demands. Now, we can, in the West, we say that's unreasonable. Oh, Trump, but Putin can't do that. Well, they're doing it, okay? And they are, it's not Putin. You hear the same thing from Lavrov. You hear the same thing from Deputy Foreign Minister Rybakov. You hear it from Gerasimov, the head of the military. I mean, this is, the Russians are quite united on this, and they're not kidding. This is fundamental demand. And I say it's inflexible in the sense they're not going to back away from that. Now, if Ukraine doesn't take that deal, then it's going to get upped, because the next step, they'll take Odessa, they'll take Kiev, they'll take Sumy, they'll take other Dnipropetrovsk. So there's going to be other areas that they're going to take control of. And whatever territory Ukraine thought it had east of the Dnieper River will no longer be Ukrainian. So Russia's going to settle this one way or the other. Militarily, I think it's going to ultimately get settled militarily.
Larry, before wrapping up this session, you wrote a piece on your website, sonar21.com.
Was it brilliant?
Brilliant. As always.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm insecure. I'm fishing for compliments.
Yeah, it was brilliant.
Okay, which one was it?
Yeah, the title is How the West Plays Politics with International Terrorism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead and let us know what you've mentioned in this article, in this piece.
Well, when you want to talk about terrorism, I think there are only two ways to count it: actual incidents, attacks, and casualties. Do people get killed or wounded? Okay, what are we talking about? Let's look at who's doing the attacking and who's doing the killing. The narrative in the West is the number one sponsor of terrorism is Iran. Iran's the big sponsor of terrorism. They're behind it all. So I said, well, I don't want to go on my impression. Let's just simply look at the data that's collected by the U.S. intelligence community. And then it's the National Counterterrorism Center, NCTC now, I think, handles that job. But ultimately, the State Department, my old office, it's now called the Bureau of Counterterrorism, they publish, because they're required by law every April, to publish an annual report on terrorism. And so I said, let's go look at their numbers. So first of all, they've got in the 2022 statistical annex. So the 2022 statistical annex, it was published in April of 2023. It goes back for 6 years. It looks at the number of terrorist attacks. It lists the top 10 groups. And if so, for that period from 2018 to 2022, the top 10 groups, seven of the top 10 are radical Sunni Islamic groups. ISIS, Boko Haram. Oh, yeah, there you put it up. So, you've got, there's not a single group there of those Islamic groups that are connected with Iran. Not one. Then you've got, as I recall, you got the Baluch Liberation Army. So they're in Baluchistan over on the border with Afghanistan and Iran. So the Iranians label that group Baluch as a terrorist organization. You've got the Communist Party of Philippines, and then you got the National Liberation Army, ELN. They're a Colombian group. Not a single group in there connected with Iran, okay? So how in the name of God is Iran the number one sponsor of terrorism when all of the top 10 terrorist groups have zero relationship with Iran? Not my opinion. There's the facts. Look at them. Then there's another table. I don't know if you can page down to it. Just go down to the next one.
Yeah.
Yeah, you've got this magic worked out. I ought to hire you. So look at the casualties. Who's doing the killing? My God. It's all ISIS. I mean, it's the radical Islamic groups that are doing the killing. They're the source of the violence. In fact, that's one of the reasons that Iran had gone to Syria to fight ISIS. So again, overwhelming. Now, so that's up to 2022. Then when State Department published for 2023, going down, all of a sudden, who's number one? Hamas. You know, they put Hamas at the top of the list for the terrorist attacks. Or I guess ISIS. ISIS is there. Hamas is number three. So ISIS is at the top and Hamas
is right number there. Two, Larry.
Number two. Yeah, I can't see it as well from here. And then there's also down towards the bottom, the Palestine Islamic Jihad, PIJ. P-I-J. And let's not forget the Ansar Allah, Ansala, the Houthis. They're now on the list. Oh, my God.
Number okay. six. Yeah.
Yeah. So three of the 10 groups that are listed there, boy, these are the most terrorist active groups in the world. Okay, stop and say, well, so where were they the previous 6 years? All this is reporting is that Hamas carried out that attack on October 7th, and it was largely a military raid that was designed to also kidnap civilians. Now, that's a terrorist attack. I grant you that. But they were not, this was not to go out and massacre civilians, because the Hamas saw and the Palestine Islamic Jihad saw that taking prisoners, hostages, was a way that they could get some bargaining leverage. So let's look. So how many did they actually kill? Who are the killers? So we go down to the next table. There we go. And lo and behold, they list Hamas is number one. It's the number one killer, except they're attributing all the deaths that took place on October 7th to Hamas. And we can show with great clarity, thanks to work by people like Max Blumenthal, that the Israeli military itself killed a significant number of the Israelis who died that day as part of their Hannibal doctrine. And there's other actual Haaretz, one of the Israeli newspapers, had admissions from, you know, military leaders that they had killed a bunch of Israelis. Notice, though, that now all of a sudden, the Houthis, who they weren't listed at all from 2018 to 2022, all of a sudden, man, they're killing all these people. Well, what the recording is combat casualties as a result of the war between Saudi Arabia and Ansar Allah. Yeah, Ansar Allah. Sorry about that. Mouse not working. So what you're seeing here is this is a political document. This is not actually trying to make an objective judgment about terrorism. And yet, take out Hamas. You notice that Hezbollah's not on that list. I forgot to mention Hezbollah was up on the other list of, Hezbollah got included on the list of terrorist attacks.
Yeah, in 2023, yeah. Number four.
Yeah. They're number four. They're really attacking. And then you get down to casualties. They're not even on the list of as a group causing casualties. Yeah. Okay. that it's like, oh, you're carrying out attacks, but you're not killing anybody. Okay. That makes sense. So Palestine is Islamic Jihad, PIJ, they're not on there either. So it just it illustrates, I think this illustrates pretty clearly just the how manipulative and political these kinds of statistics are. It's designed to paint a picture. But the reality is Iran is not even a minor sponsor of terrorism. Iran is a country that has been under terrorist attack by the West and when it does things to defend itself, immediately gets labeled as a terrorist. And because it provides support to the Palestinian people in particular, who have been targets of genocide, that they get accused of terrorism for that. So it's just, I think it's not a fair picture at all. It's not an accurate picture. And it's not my opinion. I'm just pointing out the facts.
Yeah, with the numbers, everything. Yeah. Thank you so much, Larry, for being with us today.
All right. Well, thank you for putting up with me. I hope I wasn't too obnoxious.
It was amazing.
All right, my friend.
Have a great time. See you soon. And
we'll talk to you, I think, on Friday.
On Friday, yeah.
Okay.
See you. Bye.